We need to integrate ethics into decision-making at all levels of the corporation. And my work is about making that feasible. I call it, on a more societal scale, democratizing ethics, making ethics accessible to people from all walks of life. But within an organization, we need to simplify, we need to have a framework, we need to have tools that people can use and reference points so that every decision doesn't seem like a whole brand new time-consuming, challenging drama.
Welcome to the Leading Transformational Change podcast. Our passion is to help you lead and build heart-healthy organizations with a culture of purpose, trust, and integrity. I'm your host, Tobias Sturson, and I'm the co-founder of Heart Management. We are so excited to welcome you back to a new season of the Leading Transformational Change podcast. As many of you might have noticed, we took a more extended Christmas break than planned. And there's a happy reason for this. Our family welcomed a beautiful and healthy baby girl to the world at the beginning of January, a bit earlier than expected. And I guess that I didn't adequately prepare for the impact on our schedule, especially since we already have a 2.5-year-old at home. So we decided that we had to postpone the podcast launch. Sorry for that. But now we're back, and I'm very excited about all the really interesting, fascinating, and helpful conversations that we will get to share. At the end of 2021, we found out that Apple Podcasts ranked the Leading Transformational Change podcast number 75 of the 100 top management podcasts in the US, which is really amazing. So we're so grateful to everyone who listens, shares, rates, and reviews. It really means the world to us, and it helps us get these conversations on healthy culture in the ears of leaders, HR, and ethics professionals around the world. In 2022, we want to keep having in-depth conversations with researchers, leaders, and experts to help you develop a more healthy culture in your organization, with a particular emphasis on operating in a hybrid work environment. A vital aspect of a healthy culture is a culture where ethics and values are central to the decision-making process. And as we all know, how we make decisions in an organization is a key part of what constitutes the culture. While laws and regulations can offer us some guidance, today's guest makes the case that the ethics edge, the areas where we can't merely rely on rules, but need our ethical compass and clear guiding principles, is growing. Susan Leotard is the author of The Power of Ethics. She holds a PhD in social policy, is the chair of council of the London School of Economics, and teaches cutting-edge ethics courses at Stanford University. Susan holds a number of advisory roles on ethics, including the Stanford Institute for Human-Centered AI and SAP's AI Ethics Advisory Panel. I hope you'll find our conversation on culture, ethics, decision-making, technology, and leadership as fascinating and helpful as I did. So without further ado, let's jump into our conversation with Susan Leotard. Susan, it's really a privilege to have you on the podcast today.
The privilege is definitely mine. It's really a pleasure to be here.
So as I've been looking at your professional journey, and of course you know that much better than I, but it seems like ethics has become perhaps more than just a job, but like it is somewhat of your passion and vocation. Could you tell us a little bit about where your interest and fascination and passion with ethics began?
So I think I'm sort of innately a problem solver. And the things that have always interested me, and the challenges that always interested me, whether it was growing up or in university or even any of my jobs, was how do we deal with complex challenges and what's driving them? And to make a very long story short, I started out as a corporate lawyer. So obviously very focused on regulation and on regulatory thinking internationally. But I soon realized that the law wasn't enough. And that really came to a head when I started working on things like derivative securities, or sort of first ever products that were happening back in the early 90s. And then we had Apple and the beginning of Silicon Valley, and the law was lagging further and further behind there. So all of the problems that were coming up, and not just for companies or legal clients, but for society, were kind of left without guidelines. And I was trying to figure out from where we might take these guidelines. And then just more generally, as I began to explore this further, both in research and in teaching and in advisory work, I realized that ethics really drives everybody's story. And that can mean our individual story. It can mean a company's or an NGO's or a government's story. And the two work together. So we're not different ethically at work than we are at home. And if we try to be, we get ourselves into trouble. And we can talk about that if you'd like at some point. But basically thinking about ethics as, what do we want our journey to be? What do we want our story to be? What do we want to tell the world about who we are and how we solve problems?
That is so fascinating. And there's so many things that I would like to tie into in that response. But one thing you were saying is that we're not different at home or at work. And I'm just thinking about that so much. I'm thinking about ethics, that it has to do with context, that in certain contexts, if we would say the people working at Volkswagen in the emissions scandal, that they were not necessarily, I'm thinking, cheaters at home, but in the context of the pressure and all of that, they were in an environment where that behavior was encouraged. Or if we think Wells Fargo and all the thousands of people that were forced to leave their jobs because they had they had sold on products that customers didn't need or weren't aware of, and so on. And again, I think an example of where the context and the culture is so powerful. So I just wanted to kind of challenge that statement. Do you really think that's true, that in that sense that we are totally the same?
So I do think that context matters. I mean, context is part of the information that we collect when we're making a decision. However, what your example is a perfect one of how what happens at work affects us at home. What happens at home affects us at work. So we see all the time, for example, to use your example, people got fired after the Wells Fargo scandal. That certainly affected their home life. We see university students, to give you a concrete example, who will perhaps behave in certain ways or post certain things on social media that might be completely unacceptable, say racist, for example. And they'll go to apply for a job and somebody will find that racist tweet or that racist post in doing the due diligence on them as a candidate. So it will have an effect on them that way. But the answer, and I've heard this myself in different circumstances, is sometimes, but I was just raised in a house like that. I'm not that person anymore. I took that to university with me, but I'm not going to, I'm now 27 or I'm now 35. That was a long time ago. I'm not that person anymore. And the impact of our ethics in one place affects another. It's not that we don't take into account context. It's that the impact spreads from one context to another.
I think that is so incredibly true. And I've been saying a lot that our lives are so much more interdependent with the organizations and of course, like you say, with the ethical stories than what we might want to think. And over the last, I would say, 2 years, I've really been on this exploration, having a lot of conversations with researchers, with leaders, on just how do we build more healthy and also more ethical cultures. Thinking about that, I think it is something that so easily is kind of pushed to the side. It's not something that is typically on the top of the agenda, unfortunately, on so many for so many leaders, and it's something that is seen like a peripheral issue until you have a scandal or until you go through something where you realize that it's not. And I just wanted to ask you, what are we getting wrong about that, and why is it that it becomes too often a peripheral issue?
I think very often people have a lot on their minds and a lot on their plates. And it just seems like getting through the day and getting through the quarter and meeting all of the different demands of employees, of regulators, of customers, it just seems like sort of all too much. And sometimes ethics just seems like a lower priority. I think to your point about it doesn't really come to the fore until there's a scandal is slightly shifting, meaning that it's coming to the fore earlier, for example, through employee manifestation of, you know, we don't want Amazon to be selling cloud computing to fossil fuel companies, or Google employees who spoke up about selling to the military. So we're seeing it in that way. We're also seeing it in employees requesting CEOs to speak up on societal issues. So it might be the voting laws in Georgia. It might be immigration. It might be something about the environment. So I think this is being brought to the fore earlier, sort of what I would call pre-scandal. The world is moving toward that. But the other reason is that very often, quite simply, people don't know how to integrate ethics into the decision-making. And I really do emphasize decision-making. Decisions are made at all levels of the organization. And certainly the senior leadership team and the board have an awful lot of responsibility there. But if we look at ethics problems, quite often they're very far down the chain. It might be one rogue trader, like at Société Générale. It might be some individual Uber drivers, whereas the whole company isn't necessarily rotten, so to speak. So we need to integrate ethics into decision-making at all levels of the corporation. And my work is about making that feasible. I call it, on a more societal scale, democratizing ethics, making ethics accessible to people from all walks of life. But within an organization, we need to simplify, we need to have a framework, we need to have tools that people can use and reference points so that every decision doesn't seem like a whole brand new time-consuming, challenging drama.
That's so helpful. And of course, we can talk so much about that, and we will. But just if you would say, at this early on in the interview, just some of the things that you think are so important if we want to drive ethical decision-making kind of into our organization. And I'm thinking that most organizations today, we have a list of corporate values and we have maybe a code of ethics and so on. But unfortunately, so many times it's just a paper product. I think the listeners to this podcast, they're very well aware of that. But at the same time, it can be so hard to know. So how can you actually do things differently? And of course, we're going to talk a lot about that during this conversation. But what are some of the first kind of pointers that you want to give us and that you've seen are the most important to make that type of change?
So I'll make an umbrella point and then I'll give you some specifics. The umbrella point is that we throw around this word culture all the time, as if it's some sort of abstract concept or some sort of leadership concept. And the way I define culture is sort of what comes out of our decision machines. So culture is a direct result of decisions being taken throughout the organization. Certainly, of course, leaders, but also, as I said earlier, many others. So what do we need to think about when we're making decisions? Well, a couple of examples, and there are about five or six things that once we've mastered these, I think we can make massive progress toward ethical decision-making without having to sort of relearn ethics every time we have a new type of issue. So the first is about what I call in my book, Banishing the Binary. We are in the middle of an epidemic of binary thinking. And binary thinking is easier. It's the UK and the EU, Brexit, in or out. It's black and white. It's yes or no. It's even terms like ethical and unethical, labels that we think simplify things. But unfortunately, the world really isn't black and white. And so the first thing is to look at issues and decide, where are we in the gray? And why are we in the gray? And how can we navigate the gray? And so I ask one question, and that is, when and under what circumstances should we proceed? Whether proceeding is selling a particular financial product, whether it's investing in climate change improvements in terms of how we run our business, whether it's, do we launch an innovation on the market, a driverless car, some social media, a new type of sharing economy platform. So what are the risks and opportunities as opposed to just yes or no? So that's the first thing, is really trying to identify risks and opportunities. And once we've done that, we can really go to work at mitigating the risks and at making sure that we don't miss the opportunities. So number one is banish the binary. Quick corollary there, there are some things that are straight up binary, absolutely never. Things like racism and sexual misconduct. So I want to be absolutely clear that I'm not saying that there are gray areas with those. The second is to be mindful of how ethics can be contagious. So ethics can spread for the good, if we proactively invest in making it spread for the good. And ethics will spread all on its own for ill if we don't, what I call, cauterize the things that make it spread. So we can all be on the lookout, and I talk about this in the book as well. We can be on the lookout for drivers of spreading. We can be on the lookout for things like classics, like greed, like unrealistic deadlines and other forms of perfectionism, like information silos, like unrealistic competition. So that we saw a bit, for example, in the Boeing case. So there's a whole roster of those. And we can also be on the lookout for more techie, edgy factors that can drive the spread of unethical behavior. Things like fake news on social media platforms or misuse of gene editing. So that's the second, to think about ethics are contagious. And there are sort of six main ones in all, and I'll just hit on one more. And that is to be really careful anywhere we see truth being compromised. Now, I say to my Stanford classes, there's no such thing as alternatively factual ethics. All ethics hinge on truth for a whole host of reasons, not least the information, including the context you rightly mentioned earlier, needs to be truthful, or else what comes out the other end of our decision, sort of garbage in, garbage out. But we really need to be mindful of how are we as an organization requiring truth of all of our stakeholders, and how are we telling the truth to all of our stakeholders? And are we telling the truth to our stakeholders in ways that they can actually absorb it and use it to make their own decisions? So to take a recent example, if you're Robin Hood and you're aimed at the general public, and you're saying that you want to democratize trading, well, a 33-page micro print terms of service is not going to be understood by pretty much any of your consumers, even if that's your sort of effort at telling the truth. So maybe I'll stop there. Those are three of sort of five or six, and those I think are the most critical.
That's so awesome. And we're definitely going to talk more about truth, and because I found that really fascinating in your book. But I was thinking about this, that you said that ethics, it's not the binary, it's not ethical or unethical many times. And again, there are some examples where it is. As I've been working with organizations and even some organizations that have gone through major public scandals, I've come to realize that so much of building a healthy organization or a healthy culture is navigating a tension. And so many times I see organizations that have been reacting to something that they've seen around them, or where the leaders or founders have reacted to something that they've seen around them. They wanted to do things differently. And in doing that, they have maybe gone overboard to the other side. And let's say, for example, we could say that having people that are super committed to a mission, that is like something that we think is critical, I think, many times, and something that we want to. You talk about strong cultures and all of that. But at the other end, we need people who are actually thinking for themselves, people who are able to challenge what is being said, what is being done, and who are not, and I think are not 100% with their whole lives bought into that mission, but actually have a point of independence from which they can actually act and react to something. And I'm just taking that as an example, but I'm thinking, so you talk about the importance of recognizing and kind of when you and how ethical culture or unethical culture spreads, and important to recognizing those signs and of course navigating this tension. So what are some ways that organizations, that HR leaders can do that in a good way to recognize that, especially when it is, as we talk about so many times, it's not binary, it's not that super simple all the time. So what can we do?
So that's a great question. And the fundamental point is that very often when we see unwanted behavior, so you mentioned the 350 million or so fraudulent accounts at Wells Fargo. Very often we see behavior and we stop the behavior and we think we fixed the problem. And in fact, what we need to do is we need to take a step back and say, we need to fix not only the actual behavior, but we need to fix the drivers of that behavior, which might be different in different cases. Now, I put in the book all on a page or two, a list so that it's really easy for professionals and even for people from all walks of life can look at this and say, for example, in the Boeing case, there was competition. Boeing was trying to meet competition under impossible deadlines. There was greed. There was faulty compliance in the sense that Boeing was too involved in the regulators, in the FAA oversight of Boeing safety. So you can choose, for example, in your particular situation, which of the drivers of the contagion of the unethical behavior are most relevant. In the case of fake news, clearly social media will be one. And you don't need to pick 10, you can pick two or three and just check, what have I done to eradicate those drivers? So to take an example, one big driver of unethical behavior is fear of speaking up. So that came up in the example you just raised. And so you can look around the organization and say, what are the things we need to do to make it safe for people to speak up? Well, one thing is we need redundancy. We need multiple ways for people to speak up. We need their manager to be trained properly. We need peer opportunities. We need anonymous opportunities. We need full-on regulatory opportunities like whistleblowers. Maybe we need an ombudsman service. Maybe we need to have some sort of an online Q&A every month where employees can answer anonymously and just general feedback is given to management. But how can we get redundancy in opportunities to speak up safely? The other piece of that might be, how can we actually demonstrate that if people speak up, they won't be punished? On the contrary, if they speak up thoughtfully and respectfully, they will be rewarded. And then the final piece of that is when failure to speak up kind of intersects with perfectionism. And perfectionism is a terrible driver of the spread of unethical behavior. And so we can look at the standards we're setting. Are we setting impossible sales targets? Are we setting impossible deadlines? Are we unrealistic about the fact that people are at home trying to work through COVID-19 and they have young children and that the amount of work they might have been able to get done 2.5 years ago just isn't the same quite yet? So where are we asking for perfection that, you know, that is neither a laudable goal nor possible? So if you just look at those drivers of contagion, very often when I speak to executives and ethics experts, a few will sort of pop out for any given challenge, and then we can go to work at dismantling them.
I love that. And just to our audience, I would just want to say that I think it's really, really helpful to find kind of who are the key stakeholders within your organization who you could do this with and really do an exercise in terms of, for example, speaking up and look at what are all these variables? What does kind of the ecosystem look like? What are the drivers? And not just take it as just a mental exercise, but really sit down and take the time to map it out, do a mind map and just kind of create that picture and look at the drivers, because I think that is so incredibly helpful.
Now, I would just say, I love your word map, because there are two kinds of maps. There's sort of one is just really looking at the drivers of contagion of unethical behavior that are most relevant to your business. So there are some that are going to be relevant all the time, and there are a few that might be relevant in a particular circumstance. So it's not sort of an endless exercise. It's something that in an hour or two of really robust discussion, and I do this with executives and with boards and with ethics experts, you can really come to a huge amount of insight. But the other kind of mapping you could do is, what happens when unethical behavior spreads? And when you don't cauterize or dismantle those drivers of contagion. And I can promise you that when you do look at something like Wells Fargo, or you look at something like Uber, or you look at something like opioids, the contagion spreads not only across many, many, many stakeholders, but the numbers go crazy. And even in non-corporate situations, for example, I understand that the doctor who was committing such egregious sexual misconduct with the U.S. gymnastics team actually ended up having 1,000 victims. Now, that number may be wrong, but it's not two. My point is that once people start down a path, if you don't stop the drivers of contagion, in that case, it was, as you're mentioning, among other things, people fear to speak up, fear that they were going to lose their athletic opportunities. Understandable fear, let me emphasize. But in any kind of situation, even outside the corporate world, we see that kind of spreading. We see it in the NGO world, for example, where there might be a power imbalance. It might be that a particular NGO is the only source of medicine or food in an area after a natural disaster or in a conflict zone. And all of a sudden that power imbalance becomes the driver of unethical behavior. But if you map out the actual contagion, for example, the Wells Fargo accounts, you would see so many people affected. And you would see very often people also in different timeframes, future generations affected.
That's so powerful. And you write in your book, The Power of Ethics, that about the ethics edge. And I think you define it as the edge between where laws and regulations give us guidance or clear guidance and where we need ethics to navigate. And you write that this space in which ethics becomes our only guide is expanding. And I wanted to understand in what ways do you think that is?
So I think the pace of technological innovation is accelerating. It has been accelerating for a number of years, but it is really accelerating faster and faster now. And also the spread of the impact of innovation. So for example, something like facial recognition technology, it's spreading, speaking of contagion, geographically. It's being used all over the world. It's being used by individual actors and not just corporates. It's being used in different contexts. It's being used for policing. It's being used in China for social indexing. It's being used on our iPhones to let us into our iPhones or our iPads. So the pace and the impact and the implications of technology are all moving so fast that it's impossible to keep up. And at the same time, respectfully, we've all seen regulators in Washington who bring in parades of Silicon Valley executives, and we haven't made a tremendous amount of progress on the regulatory side. Some of that is understandable. Some of that is unforgivable. They really need to, you know, social media has been around for a long time, and some of the major risks around privacy, around data protection, around fake news have also been around for a long time. But so that space is growing. And I think the key thing also is that much of what we're seeing today is sort of genie out of the bottle. What happens when somebody like a rogue scientist in China that the government rightly punished, edits the embryos of, you know, does gene editing on the embryos of, you know, two twin girls. I mean, that's nobody in the scientific community thinks that's acceptable today. Yet that's a rogue actor that will have implications for future generations because it's now part of the germline. Well, similarly, we can have all kinds of follow-on consequences. Somebody who ends up in jail who doesn't belong there because of an algorithmic bias. So the stakes are just so much higher, the pace is so much faster, and the technology is so much more complicated. And just to finish this point, as I said earlier, though, you know, I'm very pro innovation, and we have to be careful of the context. Meaning, you know, driverless cars are really important in certain developing countries where the roads are not safe, where the hospitalization is not available for people who have car accidents, where the rule of law is not respected, and where death from human-driven cars is so much higher than in the West. Whereas in parts of, for example, the United States or in Europe, we can say, well, you know, we're going to take our time and we're going to wait and not allow driverless cars until they're sort of perfect and perfectly safe. So there are all these kinds of considerations, but the pace, the scope, and the magnitude of the impact are really what's involved in that comment.
And as I'm thinking about that, and I think it's so interesting that you, I mean, you teach at Stanford, so I'm guessing that you're quite connected with what's happening within these fields. But as I was reading Wired, the Wired magazine, and the world in 2022, I was just struck by how incredibly optimistic kind of almost every article was. This is going to change for the better. This technology is going to make this happen. And also some things that, for example, and banking, like every company is going to have access to offer financial services and to let people kind of buy now and pay later. And I'm reading that and I'm thinking, is that a good thing? And I'm just thinking back, like many years ago, I was at a conference with a lot of people in tech, and I And this was, again, it was before kind of before the issues that we've been seeing over the last years in terms of where we've been questioning a lot more. But I just remember how people were so overly optimistic, and how this is going to change the world, and didn't really want to see any of the kind of ethical downsides and issues. And so as I'm thinking about it, I'm thinking that whatever kind of technology we create, we still have our basic human drives. We still have our, like you said before, we still have greed. We still have like a lot of these things that will, I believe, have an impact on the services we provide and have a lot of unintended consequences. But if you speak to leaders and I think also HR professionals, where we think there's a lot of things, if we think about AI, where we think about different technology that kind of promises that we'll be able, for example, to do less biased interviewing and so on. And so I'm just thinking, and again, I mean, I am very optimistic in many ways, and I also very much for that kind of innovation. But I'm just thinking, what are some of the kind of ethical dilemmas that you are seeing that you think that leaders, HR ethics professionals need to be thinking deeply about and grapple with?
So I think we need to come back to where I originally started when I mentioned banish the binary and instead replace it with constantly being focused on what are the opportunities and what are the risks. Because I think, you know, I'm very optimistic. I'm an ethics optimist. And as I said, I'm very pro-innovation. And part of the reason I'm pro-innovation is that I think that when we sit from a privileged perch, we have a real ethical responsibility to think about the needs for innovation in places that don't necessarily have internet, in places that, as I said earlier, have much higher rates of death from automobile accidents, much lower access to education, to healthcare, and the like. So, but I do think that it's not a blanket optimism. It's not an unconditional optimism. It's how are we going to mitigate the risks that come along with some of these new technologies? And some of them may be that we don't fully understand the impact of the technologies, so that we don't fully understand just how quickly fake news would spread, for example, might have been something we said 10 years ago. We don't fully understand what the implications are of making gene editing kits available for $37 on the internet. We don't necessarily, to use your example, know how people are going to respond when all of a sudden they can borrow money much more easily. There's an upside to that because some people are just not getting credit when they deserve it. And, you know, on the other hand, other people are going to be borrowing perhaps to feed a gambling habit, or perhaps borrowing beyond their means, or perhaps borrowing without the education they need to understand what's required to actually reimburse the loan. So there's a lot of aspects, but it comes down to managing the risks and opportunities and being sure that we identify those up front. And that, as I said earlier, we tell the truth about them. So just like we see smoking kills on cigarette packages, if we're going to make borrowing incredibly easy, consumers need to know that they can get in a lot of trouble if they go too far with the product. And it's the company's responsibility to make sure they know that, and even sometimes to put guardrails on how far somebody can go in the product. So but you're absolutely right. The human aspects are not changing, but the technology may be amplifying. So somebody who might have stood on a soapbox and spewed false information about COVID vaccinations is having a very different impact when they put it on Facebook. And it's reaching millions and millions of eyeballs.
That is so true. And we talked a little bit about it before, but this idea of a kind of truth and alternative facts. And I read that you started a course at Stanford on ethics of truth in a post-truth world. And you write in your book about an epidemic of compromised truth. And I mean, personally, been really saddened with just seeing that epidemic, and it feels like it is endemic on basically every side of the political spectrum. And I'm just thinking, how can leaders and professionals navigate in this world today where it's it's so much that kind of everyone relies on their own facts. And I think that the COVID pandemic is a like perfect example of that. And of course, I'm based in Sweden. Our response to the pandemic has been very, very different than many places. And it's interesting because we are normally, our politics are normally much more further to the democratic side, or in if we would compare with the US, but here we've been a lot less restrictive, and again I think it's been so interesting to see how, for example, in some places you've had mask mandates for kids and even kids playing outside, and you say we're trusting the science, and in another place you say, oh, that's not what the science is actually saying. So, and again, I'm not at all picking sides here. I'm just trying to think, how do we navigate that? How do we talk about truth when it's so easy that people take some data and we just kind of harp on that and we connect it to our ideological identities?
So it's a great question, and it's a very complex question. I mean, the first part is that we do need to be relentlessly committed to the difference between fact and opinion. And that this comes up in a number of scenarios. It comes up in how do we control free speech? It comes up in, you know, and again, to depoliticize the question, how do policymakers respond to facts? So you could have the same set of facts, COVID vaccinations work. The mRNA vaccinations work. But you could have very, very different approaches to, should you mandate them? Should you make them optional? Should you give a certain percentage of vaccines to developing countries? I mean, but we could still agree on the facts. I think we cannot underestimate how societally entrenched this normalization of compromised truth is. And so, put differently, this is the result of contagion. When we have so much misinformation, so much unethical behavior around truth, that's what happens. It becomes normalized. It becomes, everybody just thinks that's just the way the world is. Just like lots of people at Wells Fargo thought, well, it's just fine to start creating fraudulent accounts. So we can't underestimate how societally entrenched this is, and including with young people, this idea that somehow the truth is negotiable. This idea that somehow they get to craft the world to be the way they want it to be. I mean, you know, as many people have used the example that when I was growing up, we had three TV channels. Nobody asked me whether I was too busy doing homework. If I wanted to watch my favorite show that was on at 7 p.m., you know, could it come back at 9 p.m.? That just wasn't an option. But now the cell phones, you know, a lot of people just feel that they can control their life as if the cell phone is a remote control. And they can really, really control not only themselves, but a lot of other people. And this idea that truth is negotiable, and also this idea that somehow the world owes us to be the way we want it to be, is absurd. And so we have to look at the societal context when we're running a business, even at the most practical level of ethics officers and HR and boards and senior management teams. That's out there. People are affected by this mindset. And it means that we need to be all the more clear with what are the facts about what we're doing, about our products, about our services. What are the things that we want people to be sure they know before they make decisions about engaging with us, whether it's buying our shares or buying our product. And so we can sort of call the world back to our commitment to facts in, you know, in the way we behave. Then there's this whole problem of opinion. And I think we need to be, you know, careful of what happens within a corporate structure about expression of opinion and free speech. And different leaders have different points of view on everything from what employees can do in their private social media to what a CEO should be saying and speaking out about issues that may not have anything to do with the core business. But this is a really fundamental societal problem. It's not just a corporate problem. But I do think corporations can have a huge impact on societal behavior.
And I think this also connects with, I was having a conversation with Mary Gentile, who's a professor at Darden and the author of Giving Voice to Values. And she talks about that we can have so many discussions of that, I mean, that values differ and what are kind of the right values to have and so on. But she also talks about that we have certain hyper norms. There are certain things that most of us deem to be true about what is, an important value. Let's say integrity, honesty, respect, things like that. And of course, what that then looks like might be very different.
First of all, Mary's work is outstanding. I just want to say, though, that I think when I use this word, the ethics edge, one of the main characteristics is that this hyper norm, in my view, is just not so clear. Or put differently, the way we interpret it to make our decisions is not so clear. So let's take the example of COVID. We might all agree that human life has value and should be protected, you know, almost at all costs. We might also agree that individual liberty is hugely important. And what's happening now, particularly on the ethics edge, is that two very broadly accepted values or principles, as I call them in the book, are colliding. And people are coming out with not just different views about how to prioritize, but extremely different views, meaning polarizing different views. And we're seeing that all over the place in today's world, partly fueled by technology. So it isn't as straightforward as it might have been, say, 100 or 200 years ago. It's not that conflicting principles or conflicting values was never a challenge, but in today's world, this edgy world, as I call it, it's even more difficult to navigate. And then, as you say, there are efforts to politicize it, and that makes it, you know, even more complicated.
Yeah, so I'm thinking about that now. We are hopefully, we have a large part in many countries who are vaccinated, and we're hopefully moving towards a bit of a different future. And we're seeing, for example, in Europe, country after country are lifting restrictions, reclassifying COVID, and so on. And of course, there's a conversation going on in terms of hybrid work and what should you allow, what shouldn't you allow, and do people have to be at the office? Should they have total freedom? And there's, again, very polarized opinions there. But what I wanted to ask you and to speak to the leaders and professionals listening to this podcast, as we are, I think, for most organizations, entering, and we've already been there, but it's maybe been more of a remote situation, but as we're entering something that will be very hybrid, and what are some of the kind of ethical dilemmas that you see that are important for us to engage in terms of creating an environment where we create equity? Because I think that's one of the key issues of how do we actually do that in a hybrid environment, and how do we, which is something that a lot of leaders ask me, how do we build our culture in a hybrid environment where we don't necessarily meet our teams that much?
So first of all, I should say I have enormous respect and I approach this question with great humility, because leaders today are managing an unprecedented challenge. And it's a challenge that is not just an economic one or a strategic one. It is one that, as I said earlier, directly affects human life and well-being, health and mental health. So the first thing is that different businesses are different, and leaders should be left to make the decisions that they wish to make for their organizations. There are some organizations that require in-person work, whether or not the employees believe that it's necessary. There are other businesses that are perfectly able to function without that, and the leaders are perfectly happy to make that happen. But when we work for an organization, we don't all get to decide what the outcome is on that. Now, it's true that employers can think about equity, but there are many implications. When certain people are not in the office, it affects other people. Equity goes in a lot of different directions. You know, is it fair that this particular person has to commute, but that person doesn't? The other thing is an overarching concern with safety. And we're seeing sort of all over the map. We're seeing in certain countries, it's not legal to force people to have vaccines to go to work, or it's not even legal to ask. And we're seeing in other places, you know, requests for vaccine mandates within organizations or even sort of national legislation. I think the bottom line is nobody has a right to make someone else sick any more than we have a right to run a red light or to drive drunk. So whatever the solution is around vaccination, around social distancing, around masks, needs to somehow come to a place where people can feel safe in the office where nobody has a right to make somebody else sick. That's a personal opinion, but I think it's a principle that I think most of the leaders that I'm working with are sticking by. And in fact, some are putting in place requirements even around visitors to the office. They're not allowing visitors, or they're requiring visitors to demonstrate proof of vaccination or other similar issues. I think this is a time to do a lot of listening, to try to really understand what the employee's experience is, and to try to identify problems that can be solved. And at the same time, the fact that we had a pandemic isn't a reason why, you know, employees should necessarily expect that all of a sudden they can do whatever they want in terms of remote work or not. And then just finally, I think we need to be very mindful of, I'll come back to the mental health consequences. I think this is where things like compassion come in. Like, give people a little bit the benefit of the doubt. I'm not saying let people make mistakes 3 or 4 or 5 times or miss work for no reason. But by and large, everybody I know has had some issue around COVID and has had some struggle. And it might be physical health, it might be family members, it might be trying to school children. It might just be day-to-day fear that they don't even really recognize. So I think it's a time where we all need to sort of do a lot of listening, really think about prioritizing, again, the risks and opportunities, and making very, very clear that we're making decisions based on science. Again, different companies can come to different decisions based on an agreed version of science. But that employees understand that the equity is coming from a place of facts and truth. It's not coming from arbitrariness.
I love that. And I think that is so maybe a time where we should never take facts and truth for granted, but be incredibly clear on things that otherwise, maybe before, we would just assume that we have the same picture, but that we would need to be incredibly clear on, okay, these are the facts that we're actually basing this decision on.
And you know, and employers and leaders are, and compliance and ethics and HR professionals and leaders are in a really tricky place, because that science is changing. You know, several months ago, very young children couldn't be vaccinated. You know, several months ago, we didn't have Omicron. You know, which has different kinds of threat. It may be for a lot of people less threatening, certainly not for everybody, but it is far more contagious, we've seen. So the additional challenge that leaders have is to say our ethics, our principles, to use the word I use in the book, are not changing, but the facts are. So we're going to be updating as regularly as we think is helpful our decision-making to integrate new science, to integrate new information we have about the experience employees are having. But the fundamental story we're trying to tell, to come back to where I started, the fundamental principles that we're using to make our decisions, our commitment to eradicating the spread of unethical behavior, that isn't changing.
I love that. And I think about, so being clear on values and principles, being clear on facts. And as you say, they might develop, but then, I mean, being clear on why are we changing our positions and so on, that becomes incredibly important. Connected to that question, so in that type of hybrid environment, what are some of the things that you think are important? If we look away from the pandemic and in terms of the ethical issues of the pandemic itself and our responses to it, but more talk about the environment of working in a hybrid workplace. What are some of the things that you think are important to be able to do what we've been talking about, to be able to listen in, to be able to build better ethical decision making?
So I think one thing is, just to be purely practical, if I may, is to not give ourselves a pass because we're on Zoom. The ethical implications of our decisions are no different whether they're being discussed on Zoom or being discussed via email, et cetera. And by the way, to be very careful with things like confidentiality, we can all of a sudden get so at ease with our machines that things that we would never put in an email, all of a sudden we're putting in an email. Things that we would never put in an email, all of a sudden we're saying on a Zoom call that's being recorded. So we need to be very careful about how we manage things like confidentiality. I think we also need to manage how we communicate information and when we communicate information and what is in person and what is not and why. and just to get, just for the sheer sake of exhaustion, have as much clarity and predictability as possible. Because exhaustion can lead to unethical behavior. People make mistakes when they're just too tired to read the email carefully, or they just didn't pay attention at that meeting. Or they just think, to the earlier part of our conversation, that they just have too many other priorities to be worried about the ethics. And then finally, I would put ethics on the agenda. And I talk in the book about how to make ethical decision-making a habit. So something we don't need to think about, and something we don't even need to read a whole book about. I mean, literally my first chapter covers it. But just to make it an instinct, a habit, so that we don't sort of think, well, first we're going to do our Zoom call and then we're going to have 5 minutes for the ethics. That might be the case if we're launching a new social media product, or if we have a consumer safety issue, or if we have a regulatory matter, or a significant, a trend in sort of sexual misconduct. But we need to be really careful that we don't lose the opportunity to integrate ethics into every decision making. And then finally, what I would just say, to be very practical again, is if you can't do it in the office, you cannot do it online. So various behaviors, be they racist remarks, be they disrespectful remarks, be they dressing in inappropriate ways, all that kind of behavior, if you wouldn't do it in the office with the CEO present, don't do it on Zoom or online or on internal channels.
That is super helpful. And I just wanted to ask you, in terms, I'm sure that you've studied and worked with so many different organizations. What are some of the best examples that you've seen of making ethical decision-making a habit?
So you know my friend Rob Chestnut really well. He was the chief ethics officer of Airbnb and also held very significant positions in other organizations. I mean, Rob is really, really clear, and he himself even trains people in his organization, and he makes it very clear that this is non-negotiable, that ethics will be integrated into every decision, from how we might deal with sexual misconduct issues to honesty with the customer, all the way to how many drinks we might allow ourselves to have at the corporate party. So I think he's a great example of that, and what he's done at Airbnb is a great example. And, you know, Airbnb is not a perfect company. There are no perfect companies. But what we see with Airbnb is that when they do have mishaps, even highly public ones, like early on with the product around racism, they own up to it and try to fix it and are very transparent about it. So Rob has had a huge impact. I think L'Oreal is another company that is a great company. You can see a lot of their work on their website. Very, very focused on embedding ethics into decision-making. And another friend of mine who was the chief ethics officer at L'Oreal for a long time until recently, Emmanuel Lulin, was a great ethics leader. So I'll use those two as examples. I mean, there are many. And honestly, we all can be, at any level of the organization, a great ethics leader. I've had conversations with people who work in the corporate cafeteria, and they are really fantastic decision makers. They make decisions every day that keep the organization out of trouble.
I love that. Thank you so much. I think that's a fantastic note to end on. And I wanted to ask you a final question, and that's how people can connect with you and follow your work. And first, before you answer, I just really want to encourage people to go and get your book, The Power of Ethics. And I know you have a new, really exciting book on the way as well.
Thank you. Yes. So I'm on Twitter, but only about ethics matters. And I try to really showcase other people's work. So if you follow me on Twitter, then I will follow you and also be able to sort of showcase works and try to get to know what's of interest to you. I'm also findable on LinkedIn. And my book is The Power of Ethics, as you mentioned. And I have a new book coming out on April 5th, also with Simon & Schuster. And this book is called The Little Book of Big Ethical Questions. And it is really meant to be a conversation starter. It is questions and answers as opposed to big, long chapters. And what I do is offer guidance about a variety of questions and help you, the reader, think about what is the best answer for you. I don't tell people what to do. And this, the book can be used to start conversations in corporate groups, for corporate retreats, but also families, and sort of pretty much anywhere. And the topics cover everything from the workplace to technology to health and safety to even politics and civic life.
That's brilliant. Susan, thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you so much. It's been such a pleasure to be here. And my sincere thanks to everybody who's listened.
Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed this conversation, it really means the world to us if you would share, rate, and review it on iTunes. We're super grateful for all the 5-star reviews and generous comments that we've received so far. It really helps us take the message of purpose and integrity to a wider audience. And finally, don't forget to grab your free PDF on leadingtransformationalchange.com. See you in 2 weeks.